Before I launch into the overview and have the gentleman come forward, I'd like to just make an announcement here. And I know there's a lot of folks that are interested in the stranded gas legislation, Representative Fate's House Bill 16. And I want to assure folks that we're going to be addressing that legislation soon. It won't be on today's agenda, and I do apologize to anybody who's come here to testify or listen on that legislation. We have some more issues that we're dealing with on that bill, and Representative Fate will bring it back to us fairly soon. We're hopeful perhaps next week. So I wanted to make that announcement to those that are interested. And my goal, if all goes well, would be perhaps by next perhaps Tuesday or Thursday, but that's at Representative Fate's discretion as well as far as the work he's doing in amending that legislation. So, okay, with that, we will call the Commissioner and or Mr. Myers forward to make their presentation to us. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a real privilege to be with you folks. For the record, my name is Tom Irwin. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and I've been the Commissioner since January 17th. And I'm pleased to tell you it's very exciting, and we have a lot that we've been working on. Before I start with what I've been doing, I really want to thank you and compliment you folks on this committee. I know we've had to juggle schedules, and I think it just sets the tone. We really do want to work together. And I have left the commissioner's retreat upstairs to come down so we don't have to juggle again, to pay you all the respect that you deserve.
Thank you.
Since I've taken the commissioner position of Department of Natural Resources, I've been spending a lot of time in the three offices. And if you get to understand what I'm like, first and most important, you evaluate what you have. And that starts with people. People are what make things happen, and you really want to get into the departments and see what's going on, why is it going on, and who's really making it happen, and those with the intelligence, the professionalism, the experience that we need to make oil and gas move forward. And I've really been concentrating on that. And frankly, with all that's been going on, I can say I've probably spent 20 to 25 hours with Mark Myers, our director, and his people, in quality time. Frankly, part of it, a lot of it's bringing me up to speed. And also part of it is trying to tie in with what my own thoughts and ideas are for priorities. I'd like to highlight a few things. The mission. For me, I clearly support the governor. I really want to emphasize it is vital. It is vital for all of us to have a strong, healthy, growing economy. I believe that. I believe that with all my heart. I think it's good for us. More importantly, I think it's good for my children and grandchildren. And I'm basing a lot on that. We need to generate what I call new wealth. This all clearly ties in with the priorities and the importance of oil and gas. And it provides for what we all care about, the needs of Alaska. This allows our children, our grandchildren, the future. And to be very frank, that's one of the real reasons I took this commissioner job. There are a lot of things we can all do with our times, but just as you all have dedicated yourself to making this state better, I've decided we have an opportunity and I can do my part to make this state better. We love this place. The mission of the Department of Natural Resources is to develop, conserve, and maximize the use of Alaska's natural resources consistent with the public interest. Next tier down, and it's certainly important for oil and gas, is their mission. The mission of the Division of Oil and Gas is to maximize responsible oil and gas exploration and development. Now, I think you folks clearly all know, maybe the people listening in, oil and gas is one of seven divisions in the Department of Natural Resources. There are also two offices and then another board. Oil and gas is by far the main issue in the Department of Natural Resources because it generates the revenue. It's the key money-generating issue in our state. In oil and gas, as their responsibilities, you have the oil and gas development and exploration, oil and gas resource assessment, lease and administering oil and gas rights, oil and gas permitting, negotiation and management of oil and gas units, selling state royalties on oil and gas, and verifying oil and gas revenues. My priorities, and will be the priorities for the whole group, everything starts with integrity. We think if you don't have integrity, in my world, you don't have anything. We think that's important. When you say something, people can believe it, and they know you mean it. Professionalism. That includes a whole bunch of issues, but it's really doing the job right, and that's all the way from representing the people of Alaska, generating new wealth, making sure the job's done right on an environmental basis. I think it's really important to have teamwork. And I'm not talking about just teamwork in DNR. I'm talking about the teamwork that you folks offered to me to begin with when we juggled schedule. It should permeate the state. In addition to the teamwork ties in with integrity, I think you need to have ethics, you need to have cooperation, and frankly, our state deserves a good measure of enthusiasm. And we intend to bring that into the DNR world. This committee clearly understands the missions and the measure statements. And that's the way it should be. From the world I came from, I can easily switch to missions and measures because I call them goals and objectives. You need to say what you're going to do, and you need to be able to be measured against it. Are you progressing in the right direction? I don't think Mark will highlight this, so I'm just going to take a couple minutes to comment on. I'd like to give him and his group the credit for the major department accomplishments last year. Significant. Oil and gas missions and measures. They collected and accounted for over $890 million in oil and gas royalty, settlement, rental, federal share, and bonus revenues, and participated in other DNR revenues. Oil and gas, they recovered a sizable, resolved a sizable audit dispute with BP, and closed out several long-standing audit claims with other leases. Total revenues generated by these settlements equaled $48 million. Leased 1.6 million acres in four oil and gas lease sales. They issued an exploration license totaling 482,000 plus acres. They also issued 65 shallow natural gas leases totaling 452,000 acres. They participated in the renewal of the right-of-way, the TAPS. They participated in a large number of facilities ancillary to TAPS and for five common carrier pipelines on the North Slope. They provided technical and policy support to the governor on the gas pipeline policy group and the legislators' gas pipeline review committees. They permitted 1,465 square miles of 3D seismic lines shot on the North Slope, and that's about 3.5 times the amount shot the previous year. They participated in and concluded six right-of-way leases for pipelines. This is the start of the list. Why I wanted to read through it, and in conclusion for this introduction, as I've gone through the departments, I can speak for Marks at this time, and I'll speak for the others in other meetings. But for Marks' division, I really want to compliment them for the way they've welcomed me, their ideas, what can lead toward the good of the state. I feel they're very strongly unbiased except for one area. They want what's best for all of us, and that's what I want. And so I think it's very appropriate, and frankly, you folks know, I don't know the details, and we all know that. So it's appropriate at this time. Again, I want to thank and recognize Mark and turn the real presentation over to Mark Myers. Unless there's any questions, thank you.
Commissioner, thank you very much. We really do appreciate your thoughts and sentiments, and we look forward as a committee to working with you and And I think we're off to a very good start here. And I'm not going to try to embarrass you and put you on the spot by asking any detailed questions, because I know you're...
I would just be honest and say, I really don't know. Help me, Mark, so thank you.
Right. Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Commissioner, I do apologize, but we have one thought from Representative Roper.
Oh, I changed my mind. I'm not going to ask him.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Mark Myers, the director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and I very much appreciate Commissioner Irwin as well. He's just bringing in a great set of knowledge and understanding to the division and to the department in general, so we're thrilled to have him, and it's been delightful for us as well. I'd like to do a couple things in the technical part of the briefing, and not only talk about what the division does, but sort of kind of our crystal ball of oil and gas exploration development activities in the upcoming year, including this winter's work, but also look at maybe some concepts that might lead to future growth in exploration and development of the North Slope, clearly, and other places in Alaska, and some of the things the division is doing, some of the things the state might do in addition to that to help accelerate exploration and development. Again, these are ideas. They're just kind of to give you the view from 30,000 feet to kind of look down on our oil and gas industry and where it may be headed, and hopefully where what the state can do to help it help increase production. This first slide shows the percentage of the U.S. reserves that are known, basically proven reserves on the North Slope, and that's about 8 billion barrels of oil. That is a lot of oil. This is a very good news slide. That's sort of oil that's in the bank under the right economic conditions that can be produced. In addition to that, there's a lot more exploration potential. In fact, the exploration potential significantly exceeds that number. So you can look at the North Slope and say it's declining in some aspects, but you can't say the glass is necessarily half empty yet. The known reserves are more than half empty, but the potential is there for a lot more oil and gas, and that's really significant. We can't undersell the North Slope. We can't undersell our state's petroleum potential in general. Also, that number is large enough, it has a significant impact on domestic oil production. So we do have a seat of the table on national energy issues, and with the federal energy legislation, we are a major player, and that's based on the blessings we have by having this large petroleum resource available to the state. And the good news is a lot of that resource is on state lands, belonging to us. Same thing is gas reserves. The 35 TCF gas at Prudhoe Bay and Point Constant is a significant part of the U.S. total reserves, and the exploration potential on that we'll talk about is almost astounding in Alaska. Then finally, we are a major part of the United States oil production. We're still about 20% at about 1 million barrels per day. We'll talk more about that. That is a lot of our national security tied up in that Trans-Alaska pipeline, that oil. So again, on national issues, we are important. The revenue picture, as Commissioner Irwin talked about, much of our state revenue comes from oil and gas. That's no secret. Here's the actual numbers for FY02. On the royalty side, and if you look at that, the upper red is Department of Natural Resource, Commissioner Irwin's level of responsibility. The lower is Department of Revenue's responsibilities on the tax side. So I think there's a clear distinction between us as the managing the resource on behalf of the state, and a differential between the folks that manage tax issues. And often folks, in fairness, look at issues differently, whether the tax or whether the owner of the resource. Also, as the resource owner, our basis for decisions are lease contracts and other contracts, and tax is based on more straightforward on law. Once you have a contract, a deal's a deal, and you're set with a contract. That brings up the issue of negotiations. Our commercial negotiations become critically important to the state, because once the contract negotiations are done, you live with the deal. So if you see there, again, the number is a little less than the previous fiscal year. The good news is, and that's price-related, the good news is the production is actually slightly up. And that's the first time we can say that since about 1988. And that is a very good piece of news. And again, on the right, the pie diagram, it just shows of our unrestricted revenue, 82% of it comes from oil and gas. And in the near future, I hope that percentage actually goes up. The issue at hand, I think, this production chart shows it very well. It shows a number of different points. One is, again, it shows you the peak production there at the top, in about a little over 2 million barrels per day in about 1988. and then the continual decline of production down to our current level of just over 1 million barrels. Important to this slide is that we are flattening that decline, but it's still over time going to occur unless new reserves are brought online, and that means new discoveries made and existing uneconomic reserves produced. Another key part of this slide is if you look at the lower blue line here, the darker blue, that is the Prudhoe Bay field itself. So you can see back in the good old days, in the late 80s, over 1.5 million barrels per day came out of Prudhoe Bay, the bulk of our production from a single field. And then the next lighter blue color on top of that is the Kuparuk oil field. That was the bulk of the remainder. Relatively simple production, most of our production coming from two major fields. And then you can see on the right the decline coming down. You see the barrels of oil on the left graph, and time is on the lower axis. That over time, our production has dramatically decreased. So if you look at the current picture, in order to make up for the production lost by the two blues, a lot of production from smaller fields have had to come online. And that's going to be a prevailing theme in the future. If we're going to stop the production decline, it's not going to come probably from a single large discovery, but from lots of small fields, lots of satellite development. The best we can do with the existing fields is lower the rate of decline. So we're playing a game where new discoveries become incredibly significant, and there's lots of implications for the state's role in that. To show you, illustrated, here's the Prudhoe Bay slice taking out of that peak production there over 1.5, almost it's about 1.6 million barrels per day. There's the decline off Prudhoe Bay main reservoir. The darker blue is satellite production. Satellite production is increasingly more important, but you can see the satellites within Prudhoe Bay are dwarfed by the main reservoir. So we're simply not going to replace the production we need from satellite development, existing satellites. They will help, though, and it's important. Kuparuk the same way, although here you see a couple of different scenarios. One is this wedge here is the heavy oil zone. You can see dramatically how much heavy oil can add to the Kuparuk field production. Here's the decline of the main reservoir. That is continuing on a regular, predictable pace. And then here's all the satellites, Meltwater, Tarn, Tabasco, and this other is primarily the Palm discovery wedge. But here's this big wedge of potential heavy oil. Heavy oil is going to be an important element. We need to increase heavy oil production. It'll come from the West Sac field in Kuparuk, the Schrader Bluff in Milne Point, and the Schrader Bluff in Prudhoe Bay field. A big fly, but again, you can see here it's not going to totally offset production or merely slow the decline. But a very important element. Here's another, what I consider a very good news slide. This shows that in spite of those decline, the reason we have flat production now is the incremental increase in new production coming from new fields and from parts of fields that weren't producing before. If you look at it from 95 to the present, we have 26% of our current production coming from production that was not online. And particularly spectacular here are the new fields, the Colville River, the Alpine Field, the Prudhoe satellites playing a role here, and North Star Field, which is still ramping up. So very good news. You can't say the industry's been static in Alaska, and I'll show you more demonstrations of these satellite projects going on. The bad news is you need these types of projects just to break even. So if you're growing production, you've got to do more. You've got to find more fields in the future. The other challenge is that the easier to develop satellites are being developed and are in development or in production. So more and more of that additional production is going to have to come from new discoveries if we're going to offset more of that decline. Show you North Slope activity real quickly. Exploration activity out here at ConocoPhillips drilling a well in the far western portion of the northeastern area of NPRA, Pouviac. Well, that is the winter well. It's going to be drilled off equipment that's staged out there. It's a long ways by ice road out there. It's the lesson, almost too far. So in the cases of wells like this where we're moving away from infrastructure, the ice road conditions make it difficult. It takes a long time to get the ice road, and the shorter drilling season makes it hard. So we'll meet situations either have an alternative or stage equipment. But anyway, that's one exploration well. Another major exploration well here is just over here, just west of Kuparuk, called Oberon, that will be drilled this winter, but also by ConocoPhillips. Then we have an exploration unit up here with our exploration wells being drilled by Pioneer Resources and Armstrong Energy out in the Beaufort Sea. A newcomers to Alaska, drilling three wells out there in the Beaufort. Then we have the McCovey prospect that the governor talked about in his campaign on the offshore, which just completed drilling by Encana. and with partners, other partners. And then we have the gas hydrate experimental well being drilled by Anadarko over here. So not a lot of activity, some very expensive wells, but covering a significant variety of the area of the North Slope. That's the exploration activity. Also, you can see here the units, probably if you're familiar with earlier maps, the units now, like the park units, extending down further and further this way. Alpine has been expanded. It's been very active expanding units. One of the jobs of the state is to manage that process and negotiate fair terms for those unit expansions. We'll talk about that. But that's critical to get that satellite development ongoing and continuing, is that the state play an active role and do good negotiations in units to make sure we get our fair royalty share and decent work commitments, but also not slow up the process, that we're efficient and relatively fast in issuing these unit decisions. And I'll show you the magnitude of the effect on the division's workload on that later. Okay, look, we've got some, I think, very good news. Readout shows the best news is offshore field here. Forest Energy has started production. That field alone will add about 50% incremental production to Cook Inlet. And there's at least 100 million barrels, between 100 and 200 million barrels in that discovery there, readout. So that first oil was made, I believe, in November of that field, and it's starting to accelerate production. Very good news. It also illustrates that even in a very, very mature basin like Cook Inlet, there are very large oil fields still to be found. Again, important in the exploration aspect. Phillips is drilling another well in the Cosmopolitan unit down here, another oil test down here to try to determine how much oil is present in the Cosmopolitan unit that the state formed. Another potentially very large impact if successful to the state, very positive. And a lot of gas exploration going on. You can see these are new gas units formed last year. Agreements with the state, SERI, and the lessees, Marathon and Unocal. And we had successful exploration here in the Nilchik unit, finding significant quantities of gas here. And you know about the expansion of the pipeline down to Nilchik up for gas. So some significant new gas reserves have been added. We have over here Aurora Gas doing some good work over here on re-entering wells and getting new gas production online. We have a company called Pelican Hills up here in this area actually doing work on mental health trust. So you're hearing a lot of oil company names you probably haven't heard before, you know, and that's very positive. We're seeing now the industry broadening out, new players coming in, which we believe are critical to future production. The other last piece I want to mention is at the Pioneer unit up here, we have Evergreen Resources drilling coal bed methane wells. They completed 8 wells. We'll see, hopefully it'll test out commercially. They're a high quality company, and coal bed gas could have a significant impact and increase supplies, particularly in the Mat Valley area first, but also in other areas of the state. So we're real excited about potential for coal bed. It works out, and we've got a real first-class company in Evergreen doing the delineation. So, again, a lot of positive activity going on, both in oil and gas, and Cook Inlet is not acting like a sleepy old basin anymore. Again, it's very positive. I mentioned before, though, in order to increase production, we can't just produce what we know we have. We have to find more oil and bring that online. This is a chart that shows historical number of exploration wells drilled in the state, starting pre-statehood in about 1947 to the present. And this is the number of wells up here. You can see we had two major peaks, if you look at it. One here, starting in the pre-Prudhoe Bay, and then in the Prudhoe Bay discovery zone here, high oil prices. Major discovery. Then we had another round post Prudhoe Bay, and then the decline in 1985 after the crash in price. We've never recovered from that. The number of wells drilled in the slope are significantly less. We need to get those numbers up in order to increase that production to these kinds of levels that we're seeing here. So we have to stimulate more capital investment, more exploration, drilling, it's the leg of our stool that's the weakest, in my opinion. The good news is, the technology is such as 3D seismic has revolutionized the success rate. If you look historically, prior to the mid-90s, we had about 3% rate of exploration drilling to commercial success. Now we have over 30%. So it's a tenfold increase in exploration success. We also are able to commercialize smaller fields because the economics are better. So we're bringing in a lot more oil online. Like I said, the North Slope and the Cook Inlet and other basins are far from being spent. So we have the resource, we have the potential. Now we have to get the capital there and the exploration going. How do others view us is really important to that process. And what do other people look at potential? These are the folks that are drilling the Pioneer Resources in Armstrong. And this is one of Tim Bradner's back here articles. give him proper credit. If you look here, this is an independent geologist who spent millions of dollars to buy the leases and is now drilling them less than 2 years later from purchasing them. So the North, let me read it. The North Slope is one of the greatest oil and gas systems in the world from a geologic perspective, says Bill Armstrong, president of Denver Base Armstrong. Alaskans forget how really good the North Slope is. It's right in your backyard. Okay. Those are very important statements for us. They have an appreciation. So there is a willingness to explore if the conditions are right, and we need to bring that capital up there. So it's an exciting time. We're at a transition time where I think we can bring more capital into the North Slope and the other basins. What do these folks need? Again, the needs of these folks are slightly different than the established majors. Some parallel, some are different. One thing is, when you come into a new area, you're the new kid on the block, you have a lot of learning to do. So they clearly need better access to data. The department, in conjunction with Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, is working on getting access to digital well data over the internet, so all that important data in the wells can be downloaded over a website based on a DOE grant. And we're a long ways, and within a year we will have that system working well. Critical to someone in Houston or in London or wherever these independents or other companies might be, that they can pull up information that's critical to the evaluation of Alaska over the internet. It's a big effort, but we should have that working within a year, at least for the exploration data, and we're excited about that. Our core data needs to be more readily accessible. The rock data from the wells. Seismic data, we need to do a better job of seeing seismic data distributed. All that critical information, technical information, that really makes a difference. Access to state land, our area-wide sales are working great, and you'll see the statistics on that a little bit later. So our state land, we really have an effective system. That combined with exploration licenses and shallow gas leasing gives us three separate programs that we manage that are all being very successfully used. But we need to see additional access to federal land. And I'll talk about that a little bit. That's ANWR and NPRA are the two big areas. And I'll talk about the resource potential in those areas in a little bit. So the state needs to be active. I know you guys are. You just passed the ANWR resolution. The state needs to actively play a role in promoting responsible development, exploration development in these areas if we're going to have the maximum benefit of increased production. Economic viability of smaller fields are dependent on reasonable access to existing infrastructure. As we find more and more oil and gas, you look statistically, the fields you're going to find it in are going to be smaller and smaller. Many of these fields are going to be dependent on existing infrastructure or multiple fields clustered together to create the infrastructure for managing the development. Environmentally, you prefer to have the least amount of facilities as you need to develop the resource. So additional competitive processing facilities are not generally in our best interest. So we need to have a way for folks who define these smaller fields to use existing infrastructure and also that we can cluster in new areas, maybe cluster developments around infrastructure to maximize its productivity. That's important for these smaller fields. That includes processing facilities. It includes access to pipelines at reasonable rates, and it includes, again, our efforts in unitization. When we create units to maximize production, one of the goals is conservation of resource and maximizing production. So the state does have a role, and then our royalty agreements in some cases, we'll talk about that briefly, are a tool in aiding us in being able to do that. Talk a little bit about the leasing. To back up the statement, the area-wide system is working very well. Here's our current level of leasing. This number will go down a little bit as Petro-Canada had to relinquish some of its leases. It's not because they don't like Alaska, it's because they bought too much. They bought over the 500,000 acre limit, and they physically had to relinquish it. They did it very reluctantly, but they ended professionally. This number won't drop down all that much, though. They'll still be well over 5 million acres. You can see historically, if you start back here from 60 to the present, we have by far the most acreage ever under lease right now. And that's just conventional lease that doesn't include exploration licenses, where almost another 2 million acres will be involved.
Excuse me, Mr. Mark, I'm sorry. Mr. Myers. I wanted to ask you what your opinion was on that as far as seeing such a substantial spike. I mean, it just seems so unusual to see it kind of creeping along and all of a sudden it just shoots way up. Do you have any thoughts as to why it's skyrocketing like that?
Mr. Chairman, there's two major reasons. One is we opened up the North Slope foothills for exploration. This very gas-prone area got a lot of excitement from other companies that are not traditionally explored up here, including companies like Petro-Canada, Burlington Resources. Unocal came back, bought some acreage, and Canna and Anadarko were very active. So the non-traditional companies spent a lot of money down there acquiring acreage in the new area, so that's a big chunk of it. The other is the issuances of those shallow gas leases we talked about. The shallow gas leasing program we got implemented and going, so there's a bunch of acreage under the lease. So those two make up most of the difference we see there.
For the record, I wanted to note that Representative Skrtula and McGuire joined us shortly after the opening of the meeting. And I might also note for the group here, you're encouraged to jump in with any questions or comments you might have as we go along. So,
Representative Roper. Mr. Chairman, I just can't pass up this opportunity to say that it's a real pleasure to serve in the legislature when we can see bills that we've been involved with actually show up and make an impact. It really is. It's gratifying.
Really?
I agree.
I won't spend a lot of time, but our area-wide sales have gone off predictable. They have not been interrupted by lawsuits. We've had a very successful process of creating best interest findings. The area-wide sale also allows the same best interest findings to stand for up to 10 years unless there's substantial new information, then we modify it. The program has worked very well, both from the sense of being efficient from the state's perspective of not doing a lot of duplication of effort in research, but also effective in that the program has been actively used. It's now very predictable. It also gives us a good management tool in managing acreage, that if you hold an acreage too long, we can say under your time you need to relinquish it because you can buy it back next year, and we know you're going to be able to. So it's a very valuable tool to help accelerate the leasing development process. Shallow gas leasing program. The program, again, was given to the division without any incremental funds. It's been one of these somewhat challenging programs because it was, again, another leasing program on top of our existing. We had to develop different set of stipulations and mitigation measures for this. The environmental risks and efforts are entirely different from this than they are for conventional oil and gas. And it's taken us a while in the South Central region. We have three regions where we issued it in the Fairbanks, which is the Fairbanks area, the Red Dog Mine area, and then down in the Anchorage Bowl area to the Matsu Valley, and then down in the Homer area, south of our conventional leasing. These shallow gas leases cannot be issued in places where we have area-wide leases. So a separate program for other areas of the state. It's good for limited rights to produce gas only from limited depth.
Representative Knoll.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark, I noticed on that drawing that it looks like right in the Kiski area, just north of Kenai, they show that applications have been filed for shallow gas.
Representative Knoll, the chair, you are free to file, but we will not grant them in areas where you have conventional leases. So that just shows you the location of the application. Some of those will be denied. We also had one in a park which we denied. So there are selective cases where the commissioner determined is not in the state's interest as part of the decision document that will knock those out. But since these have not been issued, the good news, because of issues involving environmental negotiations, I would say. But the good news is these will be issued in early March. We put the final decision letter, Commissioner Irwin signed the letter, so within 30 days of today, those leases should be issued unless there's an appeal to the process, and we don't expect it. So there's no internal elevation of the environmental standards. We feel we've got a good set of environmental standards, and those leases should be issued early next month.
Thank you.
Exploration licensing program. The program was envisioned in interior basins or areas, again, where we don't sell conventional leases for either oil or gas. The program has worked very well. In these areas, it was hard for a long time to stimulate activity. There was an early period of exploration up through the 80s. People got discouraged, particularly because a lot of these basins appeared to be gas-prone and not oil-prone. So the exploration licensing process, we're able to offer up to 500,000 acres to a single licensee. All their money expense, other than a dollar per acre filing fee, goes into the exploration work itself. And that's worked very well. We have one ongoing in the Copper River Basin up here on the right. We just have issued the one in the Nana Basin, excellent gas potential for the Fairbanks area. That is issued, so the seismic work on that, we believe, will start next winter. And we have two licenses pending, the Susitna Basin, and our expectation is that these licenses will be issued in the latest
spring, early summer of this year. That's almost 2 million acres involved in the total of those four licenses. One of our problems is we're a bit of a victim of our own success. Because we've had this dramatic uptick in leasing, we haven't had the staff to keep up, quite honestly. You can see, I'll show you the last slide to show you the size of our leasing staff. It's vastly smaller than it used to be because of the efficiency of area-wide leasing. But that has cost us, too. Right now, you can see in this chart, the red is the time it ought to take us to issue a lease. Because in area-wide leasing, the title work is done after the issuance of the lease, because most tracks don't get bids. It's more efficient that way. There's a minimum time that we have to do the title work and do the full evaluation to issue a lease, and that time is about 4 months under the ideal situation. It's taking us up to a year or more in spite of efficiencies gained by some really creative staff work. So the cost of that to the state is dollars. First of all, we lose the rental money we would get for the first year of the lease because the lease isn't issued, and we defer the rest of the bonus bids. Right now, when they bid on a sale, you bid 20% of the bonus, and we get the rest payable on lease issuance. We're deferring the millions of dollars associated with that. So we would hope the legislature would be sympathetic to a slight increase in our budget to cover a couple of positions to accelerate the leasing process. The other thing we do that's with this is we delay exploration opportunities. Until you issue the lease, they can't go out there and explore. At least it's risky for them to go out there and explore. And so we are delaying some activities. We've worked hard when people are trying to do activities to accelerate the process, but it still takes longer than it should.
Representative Roper? Myers, you bring up a very interesting point here, and it goes back to a question I have before, I've had for a long time and never had a satisfactory answer to. When we introduced and passed the area-wide leasing bill, I thought that there would be significant savings because we wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel and redo the BIFs or best missing findings. And I repeatedly asked the Department of Natural Resources and DOG to come up, give me some estimates on how much was that saving. It just seemed to me it should be saving literally millions of dollars over a period of time. But looking back in the history of the budget, haven't you been able to reallocate or reposition your staffs because they haven't had to do that work and to do this, more of this, and is there more needed, obviously, now because it's been so successful? I'm not. And could you look back and come up with any kind of an estimate on what that first sale, not having to do it on a 10-year cycle, has really been saving your department?
Representative Rook is the chair. Can I take a stab at a few of the questions now? I can't quantify the dollars, but I can tell you what we did with the personnel. I don't know, as you've noticed, the environmental community has gotten more active in litigation. The issues of environmental protection have becoming more and more of a concern internally in the administration, with Habitat, with DEC, and other groups. So while the process of issuing the leases became relatively simplified in the writing of the best interest finding, the following process of developing stipulations and mitigation measures and working through those issues did not become easier. In fact, it became more labor-intensive. And we've been I've shifted a lot of the work that went into the original best interest findings for stipulations and mitigation measures for best interest findings for, not best interest findings, for shallow gas leases. They don't require, they're an over-the-counter on-demand, but each area has to have its own stipulations and mitigation measures, as does each exploration license area. So where the effort went in was best interest findings now for those four exploration license areas, and every time we have a major area for shallow gas leasing, we have to do stipulations and mitigation measures. We don't have to do the full finding, but we have all those efforts to do. I've also shifted more staff into permitting issues, quite honestly, so we accelerate our permitting, and because of the increased activities in these other areas, like the Mat Valley, I've had to pull people off to do more inspecting. So I've had to shift a lot of staff around. I also pulled one guy out to do more units, assist in the process of unitization. So what I did was I cannibalized my staff to make up in these other areas where we're more busy. And that's why the division's been able to keep up. But there were clearly some advantages and savings in effort with not having to do those area-wide. But we picked them up in the other licensing areas and in the shallow gas leasing. Combined with in unitization, we accelerated so much that I've had to put people in those areas. So I've been plugging the dike. Those folks have been doing yeoman service for the department by pulling in their specialization into other areas.
I've eaten up your savings. Going back to the importance of federal acreage, I just pulled this slide up, and these are undiscovered resource estimates. So it's not oil in the bank. It's the USGS's best estimate of how much oil might be technically recoverable from NPRA and ANWR. If you remember our 8 billion barrels of known reserves, these numbers compare favorably. A mean case in NPRA of about 10 billion barrels of 10.6 billion, and a mean case in the ANWR federal area of 7.7, the total area of 10 billion barrels. These are very big numbers. These are very prospective areas for the United States, and it's important that they can, that NPRA area get expanded for the northwest area for leasing, the northeast area, leasing process and unitization process continue, and that ANWR gets open. But you can see these are very substantial numbers. And if you look at the state land between there, you can get a scale of the area, our part of the North Slope versus the federal part. We still did very well in land selection on that land.
Yes. State waters and native lands in ANWR, are we restricted because of the federal wildlife refuge requirements, or that we cannot enter into those areas and do any exploration and development?
Representative Roford, to the chair, on native lands in ANWR, they were restricted to a limited period of time for exploration. So it takes congressional reauthorization, I believe, of exploration and development in ANWR for the KIT lands. They're closed. On state lands, first of all, the immediate offshore lagoonal areas of ANWR belong to the federal government. They're part of ANWR, and that was based on a federal ruling. Offshore of that, we are not restricted from leasing state submerged lands to the 3-mile limit. One of the things that really can help exploration and development, I think this is one of the real win-win situations, is to streamline the permitting process. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but this will advocate that we do it professionally, and we understand the technology, and we use the best available science. And that's really beyond rhetoric. This slide just shows you some of those techniques and technology changes that really have a dramatic advantage to the state of decreasing impact to the surface and to other resources. This technology trends continues rapidly. This just shows some of the technology, decreased pad sizes, extended reach drilling, that the wreck as we keep reaching further and further directions, the use of 3D and seismic to accurately site facilities to minimize exploration development impact, the accuracy of the directional drilling as well, and horizontal wells allow you to produce lower productivity reservoirs. Then the use of ice and winter-only exploration has been extremely valuable. The capability to tunnel greater distances for underground pipelines and connections, again, can minimize under-river crossings instead of over-river crossings. And in some cases, longer sections of pipeline may be better to actually bore rather than to trench. So tremendous changes in the technology, tremendous effects, impacts. Government has to keep up. It's always hard for us to keep up with the best in the private sector, but we have an obligation when we permit to be able to use the science and incorporate it. And that's one of the goals of the department. Again, we look at the future. This is Anadarko's view of an Arctic platform. It has, I think, huge potential impact to minimize environmental damage. A lot of the complaints and issues areas like ANWR is there's not enough water for ice roads and for ice pads. Well, here's assistance that could be rollagoned out there without ice roads, developed without ice or gravel pads, and could allow long-term testing in environmentally sensitive areas. So again, it's nice to see when technology really comes with a win-win situation that can both increase oil and gas production and also allow exploration development activities in more sensitive areas. I think it's one of the true areas where we need the state needs to get the word out that we really can maybe have our cake and eat it too in a lot of areas.
Just backing up a little bit here, you had made the comment that perhaps we had to look at streamlining permitting process. Were you referring to some of the deep oil well drilling?
No, Mr. Chairman, I'm referring to the whole governor's initiative of trying to streamline that and other folks' initiatives as well. I think everyone has the same concept. We need to work together to make it work. I know I'll speak for Commissioner Irwin if that's all right, that DNR is very committed in making sure that we both balance environmental protection and streamline the process. We eliminate redundancy but not eliminate protection.
I'm sure you're saying that because my next comment was to let you know that if you can make any recommendations to us as far as what we can do legislatively to give you the tools that you need to make it easier to help the industry through issuing permits, that we would be most open to that.
I think, you know, DNR and I'm sure the governor is all very interested in input and is working hard to make it all work. But I know it's a high priority. I've seen these guys working late hours at night trying to plan and make it work. So DNR is very committed to making it work. And again, I apologize if I put words in a political sign.
Please. If you saw us working late, that implies you
know.
This is a slide to show you the ongoing development activities and satellite drilling activities. There's a lot of stuff going on in the North Slope. Again, there's not time in this briefing. You have it in your packet. But oil and gas development has not been static. The operators of the fields and the co-owners of the oil fields have done a very positive job in bringing on satellite production and continue to do that. Along with there are the potential of bringing Point Thompson online as early as the drilling in the 2006 time range and potentially production in 2008 should the project get full sanctioning. Exxon is going ahead full steam. Everything I've seen is very positive toward that development, Point Thompson. Expansion of the Kuparik, the new discovery of the Palm satellite, exploration satellite development in the Fjord and Nanook areas of the Alpine areas planned, as well as some Alpine satellites in the area. The constant tweaking of facilities within the Prudhoe Bay and Kuparik units to gain additional reserves. So a lot of work is going on. We do not have a static industry, and we don't need to imply that. People are working really hard to maintain existing level of production. That brings up what's the state's role in that, DNR's responsibilities, and the division's responsibilities is to manage the unitization process. What are units? They're a group of leases put together to efficiently explore and develop an area that might have one or more hydrocarbon accumulations. They're a complicated legal agreement. They also provide the state with, they also extend the terms of the leases. They also create the basic sort of outline for facility usage, et cetera. They're really important things. You can see the unit actions there, long list of them. The next area is the participating area. That's the area actually allocated production. That's the part that makes money. That's very important to the state, that the royalty percentage be accurate, that we get the right percentage on a single producing field. You have typically multiple leases with often different royalty rates. So we have to allocate production to make sure we get the proper percentage of our royalty and to make sure that other parties' interests as well as the state's interests are protected. It's a big job. It's a technical job. And you can see a list of the activities. It's a continual thing. Once you create a unit, it takes constant management. And I'll show you, in order to create it and to manage it and to manage participating in a 4D picture, in order to determine the state's proper royalty share and to make sure everyone's rights are protected and production is maximized. We're uniquely suited as an organization to do that because of the technical nature of our staff. But it's a constant challenge on a state budget to maintain this level of technical expertise, both in people and in rapidly advancing technology, but also in databases and in just infrastructure. To show you the increase in number of oil and gas units, if you look here on the chart, from about statehood to the present, you can see the purple line is a steady increase in units. If you look over in the far right, the bar shows the number of left shows the number of new units created by year, and on the right shows the total number of active units. You can see that bar is not only increasing, or the purple is increasing, but the rate of increase. That rate needs to increase even more if we're going to grow production. We simply are going to have to form more units because there's a basis of production. We want to form more units. The same thing with participating areas. You can see the dramatic increase there, that now we have all 56 different participating areas as well as 36 different units in the state. Once you create a unit, this next slide, I need to go through it quick because I don't want to keep you here longer than you want to be here. But this shows the units and the constant activities. You have unit plans of development that need to be reviewed, typically on a yearly basis and renegotiated, as well as constantly expanding contractions to these units. So it's almost like a child. Once you create it, you have to nourish it and maintain it. The same with Cook Inlet. We've been really active there. And the same in Lower Cook Inlet. So the number of units creates a real challenge for the division in terms of management. Our unit staff has grown by one unit manager, and I've cannibalized, again, the lease sale best interest finding to grab another guy to put him over in our section. This shows you the scale. If you look from 95 to the present, the number of unit actions processed is four times what it was in 95. It's a sign of the active development, the creation of new participating areas for production. But in each one of those is a complex legal agreement plans of development, commitments to development, consequences if development isn't accomplished, which are extremely important to the economics of the state. So it's a, one of our challenges is as we grow production in this state, we grow it over a diversified area with many more units, with an average production per unit going to be less because the fields are smaller. I'm going to jump now to some commercial issues. So we talked about how we lease the land, how we manage it, how the oil is produced. The next part is making sure the state gets its fair share of royalties. That's a big issue for us. It's a big issue for the state. When oil was initially produced from the field, there was concern the state wasn't getting fair valuation. There were a series of royalty settlements. The Amaron Hess case, everyone's aware of those. Those cases brought back billions of dollars to the state in terms of the settlements. But the settlements created a complex legal framework in which to value state royalty oil. It also gave the state the ability, or the producers, on equal footing, the ability to go back to these agreements and readjust them periodically. These readjustments are critically important because over time, the way oil is valued, the way oil is marketed, the way oil is transported, and the costs associated with those dramatically change. So if you have reopeners on a relatively frequent basis, you true up the differentials in valuation based on the settlements and create a situation where there isn't billions of dollars. In my mind, through this process, you create fiscal certainty by making small course corrections over time. Reopeners are important. The state, in order to be active in these reopeners, has to constantly evaluate where we are compared to what we believe is the market value of the oil. Are transportation costs reasonable, et cetera? Right now, the state has recently completed two reopeners on the oil side, one with ConocoPhillips and one with BP. We are in the process of it with Exxon. These are serious commercial negotiations. They can go to an arbitrator later on if they cannot be resolved commercially. To do those, the state has to be able to negotiate professionally and have the resources. In some cases, it takes outside experts to demonstrate what are the right tanker costs, what are the right transportation costs, or is the valuation methodology correct. To that end, the state has traditionally had money both from the Attorney General's office and in the Department of Natural Resources in order to hire experts and to get outside counsel to assist in negotiations or in arbitration. Our funds have run dry, and one of our priorities is to get more funds because we're in the middle of a reopener with Exxon. These show the relative value of these reopeners. If you look at them in the historical period on the two cases with ARCO, which later became ConocoPhillips and BP, we've recovered a little over $25 million. Again, this is important revenue to the state. You look at other resources we might get. These are money that we're totally entitled to. They're part of the settlement negotiations. It's important that we represent ourselves well. We're in the middle of one with Exxon, and I won't say what the dollar amounts are, but they're similar or greater than the other two. Important to the state, important to the companies. They're symmetrical companies. Will reopen on issues if the legitimate transportation costs are going up. We will reopen if the valuation or the transportation costs we think are incorrect. So everyone has an equal sitting at the table here, and I would think the system does work very well, but it requires the proper resources on the state side, so the companies certainly have the resources. Potential impact isn't just historical. That was money we recovered for the historical period. If you look at the value of those reopeners in the future, we project about $180 million over a 10-year period. So once you readjust, the state can do significantly better. Again, it's just trying to get at the true value of that oil and gas. But it shows you the importance of the ability to do reopeners and to do them relatively frequently so we don't get so far out of whack as we have in the past. Auditing the same way, any good company as well as the state needs to be prudent and do decent audits. You can see in recent history, we have recovered significantly more money in the audits over the last three-year period. It's a credit to our audit staff. It's a credit to the audit folks in Department of Revenue. So we are working hard to make sure that, again, costs and particularly net profit share leases are adequate and accurately calculated.
Could I ask
excuse me, Representative Petula?
Why the split in 2001?
There were a couple of big settlements. I believe there was a big Cook Inlet settlement. I think I have Kevin Banks on the line, if Kevin can direct the 2001 settlement. Kevin, are you there, or Bonnie?
Just the case settled.
Yeah, there was, the other thing we have is we've made up a substantial backlog. Our audit folks have been working overtime, as have the folks in revenue. They're working overtime to resolve these cases. We don't like them hanging out as long, and we reached resolution on a bunch of these audits. Department of Law obviously plays a major role in these audits, in the negotiations. One of the other issues we need to look at is, as we move oil or gas further and further from infrastructure, it goes through more and more pipelines to get to market. The impact there, you can look historically, we had about 7 pipelines there, and now we have almost 16 regulated pipelines. We need to be sure the state pays actual and reasonable costs on these pipelines, not inflated costs, and not only us, but also other people carrying gas or oil in these pipelines. It's a big issue. If you look at the next slide, it just shows you the projected tariffs eat into the wellhead value or our take on these substantially and will increase in the future. We want to make sure that those additional costs incurred by the pipelines are legitimate and reasonable costs, and not the pipelines don't become an excess profit center.
Good.
Yes,
just
to
that point, what's the reason for the graph going up into cost, which every, at least on taps, is a quarter on every dollar that we lose out of our severance tax? So what's the cost?
The costs here are, there's several elements to it. One is simply more and more oil is coming out of fields that go through more pipelines. So you have a tariff for a Colville pipeline, for a Hard pipeline, and for a taps line. So all of a sudden you're going through 3 pipelines. So, and the other cost is we want to make sure, again, that those costs are reasonable for those pipelines. In some cases, we're in negotiations for settlements or not. And we have 2 choices, either enter a settlement or to audit for actual and reasonable costs because they're required by the lease form. So the issue is to make sure they're actual and reasonable. Some of that is certainly understandable given you have to pay your fair share and you have to provide a reasonable rate of return to the operator. We just want to make sure that that is, in fact, what it is and it's not excess profit.
If I could follow up, so some of it is just because you've got more transportation costs,
yes,
because you're going through more pipelines. Thank you.
Finally, I want to talk just a couple of minutes about gas. This busy chart shows on the left the different basins in Alaska, shows known reserves, and we just tagged them for the North Slope at 35 TCF we looked at earlier. But look at the columns on the right side. That is the potential gas that's out there. It far dwarfs the existing reserve. Alaska is really, truly a storehouse for gas. We believe the exploration potential is almost unlimited. We want to see that unleashed. It could have a huge effect on the economy, both locally for your local gas consumption, but also as a commodity to be sold. So the gas line issues aren't just about Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. They're about the state's economic future and our future of gas as we enter these negotiations. So it's important we understand what we can do to see more gas produced sooner. We also have a lot of people looking at the state for gas. We'll bring in a lot more people in addition to what we have if folks are confident there's going to be a gas line at the rates are reasonable in the gas line and that folks can get access to the gas line. So these are big issues that we're dealing with the gas side. And the good news is, again, we've been blessed with a tremendous gas resource and tremendous potential outside the known existing reserves. As part of that, I know the Stranded Gas Act, or independent of that other negotiations, the state will look at fiscal terms if we are directed to. The department will look at it. This slide just points out that in these negotiations, there's sort of 2 sides. There's a tax side, there's a royalty side. On the royalty side, I'll just speak a little bit that we have to make sure the state has the right expertise to negotiate effectively. For us to be effective and efficient, we can do the best job we can inside with who we have, but we clearly need outside expertise. We cover such a broad range of issues, very complicated issues. We need national level experts, and we need highly skilled negotiators to do this. This is not something you do in your backyard. And a little bit with gas line again, we have a lot of uncertainties with it. Certainly within that are fiscal uncertainties related to variations in issues with royalties. We think these are relatively small issues compared to the larger issues of price, construction risk, exploration risk, and risks on the tax side. But they're still important. There's still hundreds of millions of dollars at stake, and they need a lot of attention. Finally, I just want to
broach the exploration end again. One vehicle we have to assure there's exploration in the gas foot in the net, in the foothills, and another area is a potential sale of our gas to an RIK sale, something we looked at last year. I'm just going to comment that it can provide some significant benefits to the state. In addition to getting more value for the gas, it would potentially assure that if gas is discovered, it would be produced earlier, and will certainly assure that exploration occurs within the foothills exploration drilling. We think it's a critical component for exploration in that area and to increase the amount of exploration in general. We also believe it offers advantages in local hire, potential processing, in-state use of gas, and yields more jobs. Again, the economic study at the bottom shows that if unsuccessful exploration of foothills, it could yield up to $6.4 billion additional to the state, produce an additional up to 3,300 jobs. So this is a big issue. I'm not suggesting we have a recommendation with the administration, but just to know that, that the contract has been negotiated. These are very firm numbers, and it exists up there. And finally, I'd like to close on the briefing again, thanking you for the opportunity to be here, showing you our division staff. As Commissioner alluded, we're very proud of the people at the division. They work really hard. There are a lot of people there very late at night trying to protect the state's interests. We're organized in small sections, basically most cases by technical expertise. We use an asset team-type management style rather than a bureaucratic pyramid scheme. All our managers are technical experts as well as being managers, and we'd like to the extent possible, be available to you to provide any expertise you should need or any help that you would need on legislation or other technical issues. Again, this is your entire staff. I think it's about 50. I think we have 56 professional staff and 4 student interns.
Very much, Mr. Myers. Any additional questions from the committee? Representative McGuire.
Just a comment. Thank you so much. I got an opportunity to see this briefing when I was in Anchorage and come down and see your headquarters there, and you've done an outstanding job, and I want to thank you and all the men and women who are working so hard. We notice it, and we appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Representative. They very much appreciated your visit as well.
Very interesting.
Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Meyer, the issue around the royalty in kind sale of gas, was there an RFP put out? Did the Anadarko and Encana come to Dog with offers, or what? How did this negotiation, if you will, situation come about?
Through the chair, we went ahead and put out a sale for our royalty gas. We followed our traditional oil royalty oil in-kind sale procedures. So we offered it out there. Anyone could bid on it. In fact, we got four different proposals bidding back. We got one from Chevron. One from a joint one from Canada and Anadarko. We got one from a small power utility, and we got one from Williams. With that, then we had a full panel evaluate the proposals. The panel felt clearly the Anadarko and Canada provided the highest value to the state. Commission approved entering negotiations with the company. We entered negotiations. We settled on a contract, which is the terms you've seen there. That contract is now out there, and it's available should the state go forward with an RFP sale. So the next steps would be for the commissioner to convene the royalty board. They would make a recommendation. A final best interest finding would be written. Then the sale would have to go before the legislature. So that's the current status, is that the preliminary best interest findings are done, the contract's negotiated, and but a final best interest finding has not been made.
Thank you very much. Just one question I had before we wrap it up here. It has to do with the security of the pipeline. I know that's probably more of a question that would be better answered by the owners of the pipeline, but perhaps you could share with us what information you might have in terms of what might be looked at right now in light of the potential for terrorism and the fact that we're on orange alert right now and so forth. Where are we with that? Would you care to share anything?
Representative Coring, the chair, we really don't do a lot on the security of the pipeline. I do have some experience in the other half of my Air Force Reserve job. I can't really comment on a whole lot on that. Basically, I think Alyeska has increased some of their security measures with it. and I think the Homeland folks are looking at it, and but we're really not the right people. In the past, there's been some limitations on access to Prudhoe Bay itself for the tour groups. Of course, in the middle of winter, we don't think we're very active in that, but in the summer, that might be an issue if you limit access to the fields for the tour companies. Essentially, the assessment is there has to be increased vigilance. I think the Coast Guard then picks up additional vigilance at the terminus as well. So I know it leads to the further and heightened security measures, more security, but as far as the details, it's not something we need to get involved with.
Not anything in the case of Osama bin Laden is listening we want to share publicly here, right? Representative Curtula.
Thanks. I want to recognize that you're doing a tremendous job with very few people, and thank you for that. And then I just had a couple of questions, and the first one was, are there any changes that you recommend that we could work on that would help increase exploration from the legislative side that would make sense?
Representative Curtula, to the chair, I think, you know, the governor is trying to streamline the permitting process, the support in getting a streamlined permitting process, whatever that takes in terms of approval of executive orders, et cetera, becomes really important. Other issues, I think, in fairness to the administration, there are multiple paths you could take to do that. Clearly, access to information is non-controversial. I think, again, the efforts, funding for efforts to improve databases, outreach efforts are really important. I would, again, personally recommend as a geologist that we have a better core facility, for example. That it's the core facility we have in the old fish hatchery is far from adequate to really get folks out there looking at the scientific data. So there are issues like that. Again, I think the administration is looking at a variety of number of issues, and I'm reluctant to comment until those policies come together.
Representative Roseberg, and then back to Petula.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Meyer, you mentioned the one area when we were talking about developing the best interest findings where you made savings there, but then you had to shift staff into the mitigation. What was the term of art you used?
Stipulations of mitigation.
Stipulations of mitigation. Is there anything that the legislature could do to make your job easier there by discouraging maybe some vexatious litigation or changing the statute to give you to lessen that amount of effort that apparently is being carried out there? Or is that even an area worth investigating?
Representative Roper to the chair. I think, the administration is working on a lot of those issues, how we manage the coastal zone process in a lot of the coastal areas. We do it efficiently, how we eliminate redundancies in the permitting process, obviously moving Habitat Division and DGC and the DNR will allow for better communication on the process. I think it also should lead to less use of the process of elevation internally. So I think we will have a more internally efficient process when all this is done. I don't think the process is adding any extra environmental protection to it. So I think there's some very good potential there that doesn't require, other than, I guess, approving the legislative orders or the administrative orders. On the environmental lawsuit issue right now, I don't really have a strong opinion. I think, a lot of it is us having to work through our internal processes. I think, again, there's some bills in the legislature now currently working through that could have an effect in terms of people standing to pursue, and then who bears the cost of those lawsuits. I think you don't want to reward people for frivolous lawsuits. But a lot of it is we do have a very, fairly established procedure for things. We as an agency, part of our role is to make sure we carefully follow it, that we don't violate procedure, we don't give grounds for lawsuits. So I guess at this point in time, I'm more in seeing what the organizational structure will be and how we will manage it internally before we go externally with legal issues.
Good follow-up. Thanks, sir. One thing comes to mind that I find somewhat troubling is that what the courts have done, particularly as it relates to the area-wide leasing sales in the Cook Inlet area, has actually removed tracts of what would have been otherwise available for them under the guise of protecting beluga whale populations. When I think, in fact, if the courts will allow those sales to go forward, that you could stipulate and mitigate that by requiring directional drilling or something there that would not have any negative impact, you know, of what they're allowed to go forward. How do you handle that when the courts inject themselves into the process and when, in fact, you think you could mitigate that and go forward with those leases?
Representative Roper, the chair. We're looking at the Beluga Whale issue just to see what flexibility DNR has, what courses we might suggest, and I don't really have a firm answer yet. We recognize that there is an issue of the courts interjecting themselves. There is a depleted whale population. The tracks themselves are pretty far offshore, most of them. So, again, I think it's something DNR is studying to see what options might be available. So I guess I don't have any firm recommendations.
Just follow up. I understood that maybe it was when the first area-wide leases came around, some of the estuary lands and on the Susitna River and other areas were excluded by the court. I mean, but those would certainly be readily available to directional drilling, would they not?
Richard Roper, I'll have to look through the exact areas, but some of those areas are wildlife refuges onshore as well. So we'll have to look at that. I think you're right. There are certain areas that could be reached directionally offshore from onshore. And then I guess there's the whole issue of what is the oil and gas impact versus other impacts, you know, for the whale population.
I just might add, Mr. Chairman, in my early youth, I had the pleasure of roughnecking over on, like, the Stump Lake area, looking out the V-door to a burning flame of wild gas burning in the Cook Inlet area for years, and subsequently duck hunted in that area for years. I mean, the oil industry's been there for years. It's the same areas. The technology's down there to make that drilling safer. It mystifies me what all this stuff that goes on. I just don't understand it.
Representative Catula.
Hi. Thanks.
Well, I'd like to go ahead and wrap it up unless there's more questions. Mark, thank you very much for your presentation and for being so expeditious going through a very thick packet. That was very well done. And we certainly look forward to working with you. Thanks to your staff. Let them know we appreciate the work they do on our behalf as well. I'd like to announce the next meeting of the Oil and Gas Committee, which will not be a Thursday. No meeting on Thursday. However, on Tuesday, we have an overview by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. And we do have pending bills in our committee, too, that will be brought forth on probably fairly short notice, but we will let the committee know in advance as much as we can. We have the Agrium bill, the Standard Gas bill, and there's other legislation that has been assigned to our committee that we hope to bring forth. So with that, I'd like to call this meeting to a close, and thank you for everybody's participation. We'll see you next week.